From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, the shelling of Homs, life on the Tibetan plateau, and treating brain injuries in Afghanistan. All week long, the Syrian army has continued its shelling of the city of Homs. Their target is the opposition-held Baba Amir neighborhood. The attacks have killed dozens of people, including three journalists. Residents are running out of food and water, and there's almost no medical help available for the many injured. NPR's Peter Kenyon sent this report from Beirut.
For nearly 3 weeks now, Syrian forces have closed off Baba Amr and pounded the trapped residents with what London Times journalist Marie Colvin described hours before she was killed as a relentless and indiscriminate barrage. Colvin's body was found with that of French photographer Remy Oshlik, not long after Syrian video blogger Rami Al-Sayed was killed. Those deaths followed closely that of New York Times correspondent Anthony Shadid, who collapsed and died while trying to leave Syria without the government's knowledge. Efforts are ongoing to bring two more wounded Western journalists to safety. The deaths have made it that much harder to get the news from Homs, a fact not lost on the volunteer doctor who spoke in this YouTube video while standing over what appeared to be Rami Al-Sayed's body.
Rami was killed because he was transmitting the true picture of Bab Amr. Rami was killed because he was filming the truth. 1,000 Ramis will come forward with God's permission. Life doesn't stop with Rami.
Activists in Baba Amr are beginning to suspect, however, that the regime of President Bashar al-Assad doesn't much care whether life goes on there or not. One who uses the name Omar told NPR via the internet that today began with another barrage of shells. He said it's hard to imagine how bad it is. Only the most intrepid, or those trying to document the deaths or care for the wounded, are venturing outdoors.
I don't know. Yesterday we recovered maybe 60 bodies. We couldn't move the rest from under the rubble. We are appealing to the Red Cross, the human rights groups. Come to Baba Amr and see this carnage with your own eyes. It's horrible.
Another activist known as Abu Hama said what water there is comes from muddy old wells, and for the wounded, whose numbers he said reached 150 yesterday alone, there are only three doctors and not much else.
There are no bandages, no gloves left, no oxygen. The room we used to call an operating room isn't usable anymore. When the wounded come in, we can put in a few stitches, maybe extract a bullet. There's no anesthesia. We watch them die, and we can't do anything.
In addition to the civilians under fire in Homs, there are also fighters, some affiliated with the loosely organized and lightly armed Free Syrian Army. The government describes them as armed gangs that must be dealt with. But even as residents of Baba Amr face a ferocious assault, in other neighborhoods of Homs, residents continue to come out in the street and defy the regime. The international reaction remains muddled. Saudi King Abdullah was quoted as telling the Russian president that dialogue about what is happening in Syria is futile. The Syrian government, meanwhile, says a vote on constitutional reforms will happen Sunday. Unless things change on the ground in Homs very quickly, residents say there's not much chance of anyone there getting to the polls, even if they wanted to. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Beirut.
Coming up, life on the Tibetan plateau and treating brain injuries in Afghanistan. This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. China's security forces have tightened their grip on the Tibetan plateau over recent months, while Tibetan monks and nuns have been protesting restrictions on their religious and political freedom by setting themselves on fire. At least 20 Tibetans have died this way. Others have died after the Chinese security forces opened fire on protest marches. NPR's Louisa Lim recently managed to avoid the security cordon around the Tibetan plateau and found an atmosphere of fear and loss there. She left out some details to protect those who spoke with her.
Monks swathed in crimson robes chant. The air is heavy with the smell of yak butter. In this monastery, photos of the Dalai Lama, seen by China as a splittist, are openly displayed, as if in defiance. Here, the monks refuse to set off fireworks at Chinese New Year, boycotting normal celebrations as a mourning gesture. "Too many of our people died this year," one told me in explanation. Police cars patrol the town streets, and on the morning of Chinese New Year, security forces took preemptive action. Paramilitary forces from elsewhere were sent here, says one monk. There were tanks too. They closed off all the exits to our monastery and didn't let us leave, says a second monk. The paramilitary police withdrew afterwards, but monks say plainclothes police remain inside the monastery. The monks listen secretly to the Tibetan service of Voice of America every night, despite feeling almost physical pain at the bleak news. Despite a Buddhist prohibition against violence or suicide, they are of one mind on the self-immolations. What they did was great, says one monk. Yes, 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 says the second. That's why we didn't mark the new year, because of them. This is the last message of a 42-year-old monk, Sonam Wangelsupa Rinpoche, who ran a home for the elderly and an orphanage. In an audio recording, he says, "This year, in which so many Tibetan heroes have died, I am sacrificing my body to stand in solidarity with them. I pray that the Dalai Lama will return to Tibet." On January the 8th, standing in front of a police station in Dalak in Qinghai province, he drank kerosene. Then he set himself on fire. This is a sign of Tibetan desperation and Tibetan radicalization. The anger has burst into protests, like this peaceful one in Nangchen in Qinghai. But others have ended in bloodshed. Exile groups say at least 7 Tibetans have died in clashes with the security forces. China blames what it calls the Dalai Lama clique for instigating unrest in a move to undermine stability. The last time the plateau was in such turmoil was in 2008, when ethnic riots in Lhasa left 19 dead. Since then, Beijing has tightened its controls on the monasteries it sees as the crucible of unrest. At Taoshi Monastery, ticket machines beep as tourists swipe through. Also known as Kumbum, this is one of the main schools of the Dalai Lama's sect. Close to a large city, it's become a major tourist attraction, with Chinese paying almost $13 a head. There are no pictures of the Dalai Lama here, testament to Chinese efforts to divorce Tibetan Buddhism from its spiritual leader. Our Tibetan tour guide doesn't want to talk about the reasons why.
Lots of tourists ask me, but the monastery doesn't allow us to talk about these things. We're supposed to talk about the history and culture of the temple, the artworks, the lives of the monks, their food and customs.
Pilgrims prostrate themselves along the ground in devotion. Only a handful of monks are visible, selling tickets or sweeping floors. Officially, 600 monks live here. But that's less than half the number of monks before the unrest in 2008. Monasteries are emptying out like this across the plateau. The Dalai Lama's representative in the US, Lobsang Nyendak, says there are two main reasons the clergy are leaving.
Either they have been expelled for not obeying the Chinese commands, and many voluntarily left the monastic institutions because they cannot tolerate the repression the monks and nuns have to undergo.
In another monastery, prayer wheels creak as pilgrims spin them. Beijing's bringing these monasteries under its control by putting government officials in place to manage them instead of monks. Here, police cars drive up and down outside. Inside, there's no security presence. All appears calm, tranquil even. But this place has seen unrest, and panicky conversations with the monks show just how scared they are. We don't have the right to speak freely, one monk says. We are scared. If we talk to you, they'll arrest us. Then another man butts in. You speaking with the monks makes them truly scared, he says. They could get shot. He makes the shape of a gun with his fingers and puts it to his head, pulling the trigger. Then, just to make the point, he repeats the gesture. It's a sign of just how sophisticated the apparatus of control has become. Parts of the Tibetan plateau, like Aba and Sichuan, where many of the self-immolations happened, have become heavily militarized. Riot police armed with spiked clubs and fire extinguishers on every street. But here, where the monks still chant and the pilgrims still pray, the repression is invisible and internalized. And the Chinese party line is to draw up battle lines. Officials in Tibet have been ordered to get ready for war against secessionist sabotage. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
Amid talk of an early withdrawal of US troops from Afghanistan, American soldiers are still at war there. Sometimes they suffer wounds that can't be easily detected. One of those injuries is called traumatic brain injury, or TBI. It's often caused by blasts, like that from a roadside bomb, when the concussive effect violently shakes the brain inside the skull. The Army has had a mixed record of treating its soldiers for TBI. Now it's trying to diagnose the injury close to the battlefield and get injured soldiers out of the fight. NPR's Quill Lawrence sent this report from Kandahar.
19-year-old Army Private Cody Dolman has a look in his eyes that makes you think he probably used to fight much bigger kids than him on the playground back home in Wichita, Kansas. He says he always wanted to be a soldier. Both his grandfathers served in the military, but he's the first in his family to have seen action overseas. Dolman has been patrolling the battle-scarred villages around Kandahar.
I love it. That's what I signed up to do, you know. Yeah, I get to go back home and tell stories. You know, it's one of the coolest things. Right. What'd you do on Christmas? Yeah, I got blown up. Yeah.
Dolman isn't joking. Since he deployed last April, he's been blown up three times by roadside bombs that hit his convoy of armored trucks. The third time was the worst.
We were rolling on a mounted patrol, and I was in the lead vehicle, which hit a IED. I hit my head, blacked out for a little bit.
At first, Dolman shook it off as his platoon pursued the insurgent fighter who set off the bomb. They killed the man. Dolman says he doesn't want to talk about that. Within an hour, he was feeling the after effects of the blast. He threw up and his head hurt. The medic said Dolman was a sure bet for TBI, traumatic brain injury. He wanted to stay with his platoon, but the medic wasn't having it. A chopper flew him to the hospital at Kandahar Airfield.
It's one of those things that, if you're treated, shouldn't be anything to worry about, as long as you're, you know, not stubborn like me.
Problem is, most soldiers and many of their leaders are a bit stubborn, like Private Dolman. Soldiers don't like to be taken away from their unit, especially for an injury they can't see. Medics began carrying a laminated quiz that tests a soldier's ability to concentrate, but they soon found that the soldiers were memorizing the answers. Now the medics carry several different versions of the quiz. But that touches on a challenge with TBI, how to diagnose it. The symptoms aren't always as obvious as Private Dolman's. Sometimes there aren't any obvious symptoms at all.
Everyone wants a pregnancy test for TBI.
Major General Richard Thomas, a surgeon, just finished a tour as the lead medical advisor to U.S. forces in Afghanistan. He says someday a blood test or brain scan may be able to indicate whether a soldier has TBI or doesn't. The Army is researching both. But General Thomas says those tests could be years away.
While that's working, that takes time. What are we going to do immediately? Immediately, we've got to identify these guys as quick as we can, get them out of the fight, because we know for a concussion, the best thing to do immediately is take them away from the insult, rest them, let their brain recover.
That's what happens at the newly completed Concussion Care Center at Kandahar Airfield, where Private Dolman is currently on bed rest. The facility has neurologists and occupational therapists. There's even an MRI machine in a trailer, a first in military field hospitals. Once the soldier is here, it's easier to start tackling symptoms. But that's another tricky thing about TBI. Navy Commander Greg Caron, a clinical psychiatrist, says that the symptoms for TBI are easily mixed up with symptoms for other battle injuries like post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD.
What's interesting about blast-related concussion is that it impacts the same region of the brain that is implicated in anxiety disorders and mood disorders. So about a third of the folks who are diagnosed with MTBI or concussion actually have other psychiatric diagnoses, whether that's depression or PTSD.
So the challenge for doctors is to figure out which symptoms are from TBI and which aren't. Like PTSD, some victims don't feel any effects until months after their injury. In fact, the Army's own studies show that as of a couple years ago, most cases of TBI in Iraq went undiagnosed. Critics say the military took a long time to realize the enormity of the problem. That raises another issue, though. For the majority of both wars, the Army kept little data on concussions. The Kandahar Concussion Care Center is trying to correct the military's course on TBI. Private Cody Dolman takes brain scans regularly. He takes cognitive tests almost every day. He recently got the news, bad news if you ask him, that he can't go out on any more patrols.
I am not allowed to leave the wire as of now, just because it's my third.
Third concussion. That's one rule military doctors have come up with since they've been looking at TBI close to the fight. It's arbitrary. No one knows if one concussion or five concussions lead to the long-term problems, but doctors think it's a good rule of thumb. Dolman decided he would probably lose an argument with a neurologist here in Kandahar.
It is hard, but I know it's for a reason, because I know I need to get treated. That way, I'm not hurting my platoon, because when we go out on missions, they can't be worrying about me. They got to be worrying about other people than just me. So I know I'm more of a danger going out to the line with TBI. So it's a big thing to get treated here before I go back out.
That argument works with soldiers. They'll do it for the guys in their unit. Another argument may be winning over their commanders. According to General Thomas, the new procedure, getting soldiers to take a break and rest up but stay in Afghanistan, is actually getting troops back to the battlefield sooner. Before, many soldiers thought to have TBI would be flown all the way to Germany for treatment. Many would never get back to their units in Afghanistan. Keeping soldiers healthier, but also getting them back to the fight, are the kind of results that may help senior military leadership embrace the new approach to TBI. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.